Presentation from staff and Common Fund regarding the Common Fund Natural Resources Fund commitment. Tim.
All right, staff will start. We'll bring in the Common Fund folks here. You have a copy of our memo of what was negotiated between staff and Common Fund structurally, but I just want to talk about, you know, how we got to this point, what we're trying to accomplish with this one, and then I'll let Chi-Chi cover some of the actual underwriting and bring Common Fund in to discuss the opportunity set. We hired Common Fund 2 years ago. We invested in their Common Fund Natural Resource Fund 9 as part of our real asset program meant to provide an inflationary hedge. Common Fund is known for their expertise in the oil and gas sectors specifically, but more broadly in inflation-sensitive private investments. Set up the partnership there. We've had a very good, robust conversation with the investment team at Common Fund over the years, and we said, this is a relationship we'd like to take forward. How can we do this in a way that more closely aligns our interest as a long-term investor in these asset classes with your expertise in implementing these asset classes? And so I think broadly you're going to see the theme coming out of staff is we like a lot of the limited partnership structures. We don't like the fact that we don't get credit for participating in one fund, second fund, third fund. It's usually not a discount to maintain that long-term relationship. And we say, well, that's a little silly. Let's come up with structures that reward us for being a long-term investor in your fund, but give a little bit more control back to the limited partner. We negotiated a similar structure with Singular Guff where we're deploying capital over a longer period of time. We are the only investor in the fund that's going to be set up. We can pause it at any point in time, and we've adjusted the economics to be a little bit lower if there's a lower rate of return. If they have outsized returns, they're going to make a little bit more. But the alignment of interest is such that our expectation is we pay a lower rate of fee. We're giving them guidance that we're going to be a long-term investor. And there's a little bit more of a conversation going on between our internal staff and the investment staff. So we're bringing our expertise up in-house here. So we think this is a good structure. It's definitely moving in the right direction of better alignment of interest. And I'll let Chi-Chi go over the actual underwriting of the fund. How will we negotiate it?
When we look for a long-term partner in natural resources, because it could get very volatile, and investment period could get very long. So we are looking for a partner with long-term track record who can deliver good results when times are good and be able to ride it out when the going gets tough. And we were able to find that in Common Fund. And as a firm, Common Fund has a very good reputation among LPs as very conscious on the fees and very focused on net of fee investment performance. The parent company is set up as a non-for-profit organization. So the parent company, a non-profit organization, has the governance and oversight on all the investment, not the daily management, but certainly on the governance side of things. In Common Fund, their LP, a lot of them are foundation and endowment. And these type of organizations, they tend to be on the more cutting edge of the things. So Common Fund has to continuously innovate and evolve just to be able to serve them. So if we look at page 3, and there's no exception on the natural resource team. Page 3, the second chart at the bottom, you can see that they invest according to different market opportunities at different times.
And that's a large part of what we're buying here, right? It's a fund-to-fund structure with the limitations of a fund-to-fund structure and paying the additional layer of fees, but we're buying the breadth. We're buying the breadth of their expertise here, and they've been able to rotate through different sectors over time.
Yeah. What would you say, Tim, is the single largest disadvantage to a separately managed account, if there is one? I don't want to presume there is, but
certainly the single largest disadvantage is a second layer of fees. So there is the direct fund fee structure, and then you're paying the fund-to-fund fee structure on top of that. I guess I look at this as saying, to the extent we're going to be deploying capital into private funds, there's a body of knowledge we need to acquire. We can acquire that in-house with labor contracts by expanding the team, or we can acquire that externally with an advisor or a fund of funds. I have no problem acquiring that externally if we can get the fee structure aligned properly. So that layer of fees is the biggest negative. The biggest positive is we buy into their legacy relationships. They're going to have access to some funds that are not available to new limited partners. It's not as dominant of a factor as it was in the past, but we're buying their due diligence process. And we're acquiring a portion of the time of a large and experienced investment team.
So, if I read this right in the Verus analysis of it, the negotiated fee structure, you think you've hit sort of the sweet spot that if you get into the higher fee scenario, it's a happy problem to have kind of issue?
Yeah, basically. If this ends up being a 20% return and we pay more fee dollars to Common Fund, what's the downside scenario here?
Right.
These are types of investments. I fully expect the rate of return to be on the lower end of the scale. We have an expectation of CPI plus 6%. Well, in today's environment, that basically means a 7-8% rate of return. I think we can do a little bit better than that here. But if they don't meet that, if something goes awry or we have substandard results, we're not paying extra fees for that. We're paying a lower rate of return. So until things kind of, I won't say wildly exceed our expectations, but certainly exceed our base case scenario, we're paying a lower rate of return. If everything's wonderful and they can buy oil companies at $48 a barrel and the commodity cycle moves in our favor and they exit at a wonderful multiple, great. It's a wonderful problem to have. And I don't have a problem paying carried interest to our GPs when they have returned a great rate of return to us here.
And we can go to page 12 to hit some major negotiation points. The first one that is important for us is the GP commitment. And you can see the GP commitment is 200,000 here. That number may not seem to be a large amount, but keep in mind this is a nonprofit organization. And just to put it in perspective, for the Fund 10 they are raising $500 million Fund 10, and their GP commitment is only 100,000. So we are coming in with $100 million less amount, but with higher GP commitment. So that shows a lot of sort of, you know, for them to put the money where their mouths are. And the second one that is significant is this is charged on invested capital. So they don't charge fees unless they put the money into work. Compared to standard offering, they charge on your commitment. So you pay them on the day you sign the contract.
So day one, we pay no fees. We don't pay fees until they have committed our capital to an underlying general partner. And then for years 1 through 6, as they're ramping up, our fees are going to elevate, our management fees are going to elevate until they've deployed all the capital. And then we start to go into the wind down mode here. So you've probably heard me, some of the trustees who've been around a little bit longer have heard me talk about the J curve effect in private equity, where in initial periods when you're paying on committed capital, the only flow you have is the fee flow. And so you're seeing you commit $100 million and their fees drop out and your returns keep going down, down, down because the money hasn't been deployed and certainly hasn't paid off yet. And then you start to come up into the positive rate of return. We've essentially mitigated the J-curve effect here by not paying if they don't deploy.
And after year 7, until the end of the fund life, you can see the lesser of language. That's the input from Barros to put that language in. So we are fully protected. And lastly, I want to hit the preferred return 7%. You don't have that if you go with the standard offering. There's no preferred return. So just to summarize, not to be repetitive from Tim, we feel like we are protected on the downside. And when we make a lot of money, we just have to share with the GP a little bit. So that's the major negotiation point.
Chi-Chi, yes. On page 9, alternate energy is described as the dark spot in your write-up. One of the things that struck me in reading that, you and I were both at that double bottom line presentation,
right,
where
right.
Solar power was one of their two dramatic winners. I presume that would fit into alternative energy. Could you sort of contrast what actually happened here?
Yeah, these clean tech investment. So these are not solar investment. And for that, I would say it's more credit to the double bottom line, because it is hard to get good result in that sector. And there's no exception for them. And they admit to me that these are more like venture capital investment, mm-hmm. with higher risk in terms of unproven technology or whether the technology will be adopted at all. So they will put this type of investment into the venture capital, which is the double bottom line category.
Okay.
We're not partnering with Common Fund to take technological risk. Let's be candid there. We're taking operating and commodity risk.
Good.
We fully expect them to deploy the vast majority of this into oil and gas. It's what they do around the oil and gas segment with the rest of it that rotates, as Chi-Chi pointed out, and from fund to fund, they're going to go where the opportunity set is. There was a point in time where there was a lot of capital flooding into clean tech, which covered all manner of strategies. I think the common theme among all the clean tech companies was technological risk, and therefore more appropriate to venture capital. This in venture capital is not cash flowing, it's all capital appreciation, it's a high rate of winners and losers, not what we're trying to accomplish within the real asset segment. We want inflationary protection, we want a cash flow element, although we're not getting that purely in the private side, but a little bit of that. And the commodity exposure is what we're trying to obtain here. We're trying to do a little bit better by going through the private route of being able to access unique assets here and hopefully be able to bring a value creation element to this.
If you go back to page 3, John, you can see Fund 9, they don't have any alternative energy so far. I mean, Fund 9 is still yet to be finished. But you can sort of see that allocation here.
So the orange-yellow has disappeared in that final.
Yeah, I mean, that's not their skill set. That's not the reason we're hiring these guys. So it would be a small piece, if anything.
Right.
Jerry?
Yeah. I have a number of questions, if it's okay. If it were not for Common Fund's reputation with me, and I think and with this board, my first thought about this is that this fund, to some degree, would kind of keep you awake at night. Because if you look at page 11, they do, I mean, you guys do a nice job of pointing out all the risks, all of which I think are considerable if there's not somebody minding the store. There is a commodity risk. If you look at the commodities market right now, mm-hmm. it's tanked. That could be looked at as a good entry point, I suppose.
Right.
That's another way to look at it. Technology risk is interesting. Foreign risk, it's tough to tell what kind of, or sovereign risks, what kind of countries we're talking about here, but it's an unstable world, and the political risk goes along with that, you know, pretty significantly. So all these risks are not to be downplayed whatsoever when you see them. I had a couple of questions about the head, if maybe they're better placed to Common Fund, but Catherine Keating, if you do some reading on her, she comes up with some stellar stuff in terms of her background, but her background is primarily as a trust and as an estate attorney. And so I'm wondering, obviously she doesn't have her hands on the tiller every day of what's being chosen and whatnot. She's the CEO. Mm-hmm. But I wonder to what extent that translates over to Common Fund. When she was with JP Morgan, she was primarily ahead of their high net worth wealth investors and whatnot. And she's got a lot of experience. She's also on the Villanova Board of Trustees and whatnot. So is she kind of largely a figurehead? I mean, a well-qualified, well-experienced figurehead.
Yeah.
But to what extent is she involved day-to-day?
In this team?
Yeah, in this team.
No.
None at all. Yeah, that's kind of what I got the feeling. Because that's not her skill set.
No.
So
she's running the people side of the business.
Right.
This team is focused on the assets. Yeah.
She's the president, CEO of the parent company, the nonprofit organization.
And we should probably touch on the structure of Common Fund, where you're going to have Common Fund, the umbrella organization that's very well known in the college endowment world. And then you have the Common Fund, I'm going to get the name wrong here, but Common Fund Private? Common Fund Capital. Which handles all their limited partnership type of business. So it's going to have the real asset team, it's going to have the private equity team, that and that sort of thing. So it's already a sub. And then we've got a sub of the sub. going all the way down to the natural resources team. So we're talking about a couple degrees of separation there.
That's actually what I wanted to hear, was it's fine to have somebody in that position that's good as a CEO, but this market niche is not her expertise. I'm glad to see the team would be in charge.
It was not a terribly significant part of our underwriting of this, just because of that separation.
Yeah, but it's certainly mentioned, you know, somehow.
It is. I mean, we thought it was a salient point because if you look up Common Fund, if any trustee took it upon themselves to do a little bit of independent research, and you're going to say, you know, has there been an organizational change? Yep.
That's an issue.
And one last thing on that. It says, this is just kind of a throwaway line, but she attributed her success, among other things, to learning from her mistakes. Did she share any of those? I was going to say, has she learned everything she possibly could, or is she still learning?
This came from my interview with her. She didn't get into details of that, and I didn't press her on that. But we all made mistakes along the way.
Captain of the Titanic made a mistake, right. And he no doubt learned from it.
But J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan does it. So I think...
But she didn't... explore that at all.
It's
kind of just an interesting throwaway line there.
It is a throwaway line.
Jerry, if Chi-Chi's comment had been, doesn't learn from mistakes, that would probably be...
Well, claims to have never made a mistake, I'd be just as suspicious, but if they were significant mistakes, you know...
You can ask her if we do the on-site.
Okay. Yeah. I'm sure she'd appreciate that question.
kind of piggybacking on Jerry's comment, when I was reading the materials, I thought it was interesting that Tim, prior to Common Fund, was an instructor of Spanish and Italian at Fordham Prep, which I thought was an interesting background to being an account specialist.
Yeah, no, he will be here, so you can speak foreign language to him.
I just thought, you know, it's interesting
what his
background.
Piss him out.
but understanding better that there's an educational background, a foundation overlay here,
there's some folks who include a lot of stuff on the resume that's not terribly connected to their current role.
And since we are on that, we can talk about the team. So Greg Jensen, he is really the face of the Common Fund Natural Resource franchise. And he is a geologist by trend. So you were able to see him today. And Ethan, my feeling is he's the next generation. And from my interaction with them, I feel like they have a very strong chemistry. If Greg is flying all over the world to source the opportunities, Ethan will be the one who will be able to do the summary and screen out the attractive investment options for him. And lastly, Tim, the instructor. He is really a specialist in separate accounts. He managed a lot of other separate accounts within Common Fund, for example, in the private equity space. So he would be able to do that for us, the natural resource.
Yeah, operations person.
Yeah. And lastly, before we have them come in, I want to address the market opportunities. If you can flip back to page 5. And this, to me, is the single most important criteria when we started to look at this opportunity 9 months ago. So we started with this analysis, and this is really, had we given you money, what would you have done with that? And these are the real existing investment they come up with. And I would emphasize on the third row from the top, the one with the white background. So you look at the core investment and the secondary subtotal. So for us, we want to see there is opportunities there for us to invest. And here, we would able to see that. Because for our separate account, we would give them more percentage allocation freedom into secondary and core investment, which is another way to reduce the fee and increase return.
Okay. We are somewhat accused of going into jargon mode. So let's make sure, does everyone understand the difference between primary, secondary, and co-investment when it comes to private equity? Primary, you're going into the fund. Secondary, you're buying a fund interest from another limited partner who needs to get liquidity for some reason. Co-invest is probably the one term is not quite as familiar with. That's where the underlying fund wants to take a position in a company that's too big for them to digest, either because they don't have the capital or because the deal is that big, and they want people to come in beside them with additional capital. You don't pay fees on that. So if someone wants to take down a natural gas plant and it's a $1 billion transaction, but they only want $500 million of exposure, they'll bring in co-investors. The co-investors, no fee, no carry, you participate in the equity. So it's a way of reducing fees if you can get the right deals.
Well, we consciously made that decision with Singular Gov.
Right.
Contrasted with another proposer who thought it was a bad idea, you may recall.
Yes.
The co-investment vehicle.
Yep.
So,
Just make sure we are on the same page with the terminology when they come in.
We're kind of hedging our bets, because if this doesn't work out too well, Singular Gov is there to refinance.
Yeah. Right? So,
I had one other comment, because Scott and Ed are here. I liked the way the analysis is structured for us to digest, and I like the sort of the peer review opinion memo from Verus overlaid to the analysis that you all have done, because they highlighted a couple of things of interest, but it's sort of like at least for me it told me what it means in kind of simple straight ahead terms. So I like the complementary approach of the analysis memo, and then what to me felt like a peer review memo of the opportunity. So for me, I like the structure. It's very different than what we've had in the past, at least from my recent experience. So I like it.
Good. Yes.
So a few questions. With this kind of separate account setup, do we have more opportunities to go co-investment with the GP?
We have asked Common Fund to structure this with a little bit higher limit on the co-investment, right? So in their Fund 10, I don't recall what the limit, it's low, and we said we'll allow you a higher limit. What's actually manifested in this, we don't know, but we've given them the latitude to pursue this when it makes sense on the co-investment side.
Okay, and then I have a few just questions on page 12, summary of the terms.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I understand GP commitment is $200,000 this time. And how exactly they put their commitment in? Is it through deduction of fees or is the...
No, they don't use management fee offset.
Okay.
For common fund,
so it's the out-of-pocket money.
Yes. Out-of-pocket employee contributions.
Which is much more powerful than a management fee offset.
Precisely. Yeah. That's why I want to get
The trade-off is you really only get that with the larger firms where everybody's still already established. The young firms that... they don't have $200,000.
And if they charge 2% fee, you know, they would use that as offset.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Now, the preferred return 7%, does that mean they don't earn carried interest until they hit this hurdle?
Right.
Right.
And return our management fees.
So they return 100% of our committed capital.
Yeah.
They return all of the management fees that we've paid. They return 7% on the carried interest to us, and then they participate on the upside.
Okay.
So we basically locked in a better scenario
yes.
for anything under a 7% rate of return.
Yes. And one last thing is that do we have a clawback provision incorporating this?
There's not a clawback provision because it's on a European waterfall. So American waterfall would be deal by deal, so general partnership by general partnership, and then you would need a clawback provision if in aggregate, if there was an early winner that they got carried interest on, and then a later loser that would offset it.
Yeah.
This is on a European waterfall, so the entire $100 million has to come back to us. All of our management fees have to come back to us, and then they're allowed to participate so that we don't need a clawback there.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So if they have a huge winner and a lot of big loser, you know, they cannot, they have to, you know, give us everything back.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Yep.
So without further ado, should we invite them?
Any further questions first? Yes, let's go ahead and invite them in.
Okay, all right. Thank you.
They showed up in force, so just be prepared.
In force?
There's four of them.
Okay.
Oh.
Good
idea.
Hi.
We've all had a chance to meet. to meet you.
Sorry, John asked me to greet you all.
And we thank you for your
absolutely.
Jerry, we're going to get you to the little alarms like you see at a call place.
Let me ask you to go ahead and take control of your presentation and start with introductions and go from there.
Great. Well, great. Good morning. I'm Steve Lonzo with Common Fund, a managing director on the team. I joined in 2003. I'm based here in our San Francisco office and live here locally in Contra Costa County. My role is a member of the relationship team and really to make sure that we're listening and organizing in a way that meets your goals and objectives. And I'll ask my colleagues to state their name for the record as well.
Tim Yates.
Greg Jansen.
Ken Scott.
Terrific. Well, I'll continue on with just a little more background on the team. Greg Jansen, my second to the right here, he's a managing director on our team. He's been with Common Fund for 20 years. He is a member of the investment committee for our private markets team, and he also has been in the natural resources business for over 32 years. Something that we think is pretty unique about Greg in the industry and on behalf of our clients is that he is a trained exploration geophysicist. And we think having that technical and operating background is a real benefit for our clients and will be for Contra Costa County. My colleague Kent Scott, all the way down at the far end there, he's also based here in San Francisco, joined Common Fund in 2002, and grew up in Contra Costa County. His mom still lives here. And his role is really to source and diligence and research managers across our private capital investments. And then finally, to my immediate right is Tim Yates, who joined us in 2000. He's a managing director on our team. And Tim's role for our clients is really to spend all of his time working on our customized portfolios. And so he will serve that role on your behalf in partnership with Greg to make sure that your goals and objectives for this private real assets strategy are aligned. So that's the team. Our presentation will begin in the handouts on page 5. And I know there's some familiarity with Common Fund. You just would have heard that, you know, we are an institutional asset management firm founded in 1971, $26 billion under management. And of that, $14 billion is on the private market side with about $2.8 billion in natural resources, what we'll be talking about today. We serve both mission-based organizations, different nonprofits, as well as member services organizations such as Contra Costa. If I think about, our objectives for today, it's really summarized in three words, we think. Trust, confidence, and execution. We want to continue to earn your trust as it relates to us as investing in this asset class, in natural resources. And then secondly, we want to gain your confidence in our ability to manage and execute the strategy on behalf of Contra Costa County. And then finally is just to bring clarity in terms of us being able to meet your objectives, that CPI plus 600 basis points for this aspect of your portfolio. So that's our objective today. We've got 5 topics that we want to take you through in order to meet that objective. And those are, we want to give you a little more background on the team that's focused on natural resources. We want to talk about, you know, why natural resources and what's been our experience over 20 years investing in this asset class. You know, and how do we invest in an asset class that we know goes through cycles and experiences volatility? So we want to talk about that. And then finally, a fourth topic, what are we going to build for you? Importantly, as you think about this customized proposal that we have in front of you, we want to give some color on what that will look like, and then how will we be a strong partner. So those are our 5 topics. How do these topics meet what you've expected in terms of our presentation today? Are there any other areas you'd like us to focus on?
Some questions may come up as you're going through those topics.
Okay.
They always do. So.
I'm assuming questions could be asked as you're making your presentations.
Yes, please.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, yep. You bet.
Well, I add a question then. Did you all get a chance to review the report and analysis that was provided to us?
We did.
Yes.
We did.
You have any concerns about that or any differences of opinion with it? Or?
No. We can provide some clarification if you like on some of the points, but no, we thought it was a thorough report.
Thought it was accurate throughout. In other words, you don't disagree with anything.
No.
Okay.
And it was really part of the basis of why we put these this presentation together to cover these topics.
Well, great. Why don't we begin with our first topic? Greg's going to talk about the team that's focused on our natural resources investments.
Great. So I'll start on page 7, and we think our strong program begins with the quality of our team. We've got 12 people on this page. I'd like to start with that green box, which is the dedicated core team that focuses on natural resources in Connecticut. We begin with our deep industry relationships. Quality deal flow for us derives to a quality opportunity set, and we think better performance for you. That's really the building blocks of where we begin. We also move beyond just our investment experience. We have also technical, operating, financial experience from our backgrounds. We think that's really important for what we do. This is a very technical area. We think it leads to quality due diligence, better decisions, fewer mistakes. We're in the process of hiring a fifth person in that green box in our Connecticut team. This mid-level person will likely have some combination of operating, technical, academic, financial background in natural resources. And that's a person that will really be able to help bolster our deal flow, analyze, do due diligence, and so forth. Our London and Beijing teams provide a lot of worldwide reach for our program. This is a global program. About 25% of our investments, our assets are outside of North America, outside of the core of the U.S. and Canada. That provides local insight, deal flow. It provides monitoring of all those assets, having those people around the world. And then we're governed on top by what we think is an impressive investment committee. We've worked together on average on that investment committee for 15 years. So a lot of stability, a lot of tenure on that team. It's a rigorous process, and I'm happy to describe that in a few slides.
Is the committee required to have a unanimous view? Can it have a split view? How does it work?
How the process begins?
No, in terms of making decisions, if you have investment oversight.
We have a consensus style of decision making. We really want everyone to say yes. We technically can have one person say no. Rarely happens. And the way we do our work is it typically starts months, over a period of months, with what we call game plans. We bring these in every couple of weeks on a project we're working on. The investment committee opines on that. The package is due on Friday at 5 o'clock. We all read that on the investment committee over the weekend. A lot of emails back and forth. On Monday, we talk about it, and we move to the next phase. And so along the way, you generally get a handle on whether people are comfortable with your decision and your process or not. And so it's so rare at the end where there's really people that don't agree. It's happened once or twice, but it's, again, very, very rare. Usually, if things are not working out, you'll feel it along the way, and those projects will fizzle out.
So you either build consensus or people just get fatigued.
Yes. And we think that the redundancy of that program is really critical. We think the investment process is somewhat of a redundant process. You're checking over and over again, getting different walks of life, people, different viewpoints, and so forth, time tested over a period of several months. It's generally the way our process works.
I think it comes down to pattern recognition. So you have people from different areas that we work in, and if somebody has raised an issue, you know, you want to track that down. Some are qualitative, some are quantitative, but fundamentally, we know over a long time period, you know, we all have experience in different areas, and if somebody doesn't really feel that good about it, or what we do, it's better generally not to do it. And so that's why we don't typically have decisions that we're making where, you know, you've got dissension and 3 for and 2 against, and you're trying to convince somebody. It goes over a long enough time period where you've identified those issues where you say, you know, maybe it's one we keep an eye on and we'll catch them next time.
Greg, a couple of things on 7 before we leave that. I noticed there's no San Francisco linkage. You might talk about that a little bit when you have an office here. But the other is you might describe just very briefly what the role that Deloitte and Cowan and Company play you described this as the primary team, so.
Sure. The San Francisco office is mainly a marketing office. Ken Scott is there on the investing side. Ken actually has a deep background in natural resources. Ken started in 2002 working with me on my team, and then filtered over towards the private equity side of the business. Ken actually has four investment assignments still in natural resources. We don't consider him on the core team, but he's here in San Francisco to help out, especially on things like oil and gas west of the Mississippi River, the clean energy business, which has a lot of emphasis here in this part of the world. Ken's a great resource to us, but we don't directly attribute him to the natural resources team. We have a team of 50 people, 25 investment professionals. Pretty much everyone touches natural resources, but the 12 of us on this page are the ones that we would consider a bit more core as far as their time and attention.
Okay, the Deloitte and Cowen roles?
Sure, those are, and probably bad formatting on our part, Paul Iannone, associate, and Steve Burry. Paul worked at Deloitte before joining our team. That's his business experience.
Oh, all right. That's what that means. Okay.
And then Steve
looks like
was
the bullets should have been in.
Yeah. Steve was on the banking side.
Okay.
Steve worked on the mining side.
Okay.
Tim?
Good. So I'm going to just pick up on the next page eight to talk a little bit about why natural resources, why continued investing in natural resources, and we think there are three fundamental reasons to allocate capital to this area. The first and most important for us is performance. We're targeting net returns of 10 to 15% over a full cycle across different commodity cycles in this asset class, and we think that's very important to our investors. The second reason would be for diversification. These assets and our experience has been that they typically have low to negative correlations with other strategies, so equities and fixed income as an example, and could provide a diversification benefit to the total portfolio. The third reason that we invest in natural resources is for the potential to hedge against inflation. So it's part of your real asset bucket, an important component in thinking about preserving real purchasing power over time. And if we think just specifically about performance on page nine, while we target 10 to 15%, over our 20-year period, we've been able to generate returns at the upper end of that range, so north of 14% on a net basis. To investors. And that's across everything we've done, both realized and unrealized, so companies that have been sold and companies that still remain in the portfolio. In the case of metrics from a performance standpoint, one of the things we're most proud about is the cash we've returned back to investors. So we've sent back $2 billion of cash to our investors on a $1 billion cost basis. So that's effectively a 2x net return cash on cash multiple. And we think that's very beneficial to our clients who are either mission-based or have members or have retirees and so forth.
And then we also took a look, Tim's outlining absolute performance, which we have targets for. We took a look at our track record over 20 years with the team you see here in place in the decision-making process. We talked about against a metric we know that you use, which is inflation plus 6% or 600 basis points to see how that track record matches up against that benchmark. And what you'll see, referring to slide 10, is that we've outperformed that metric by 20% in total. And if you put it on an annualized basis, so what does that mean? You know, if I looked at it on a year-by-year basis, that would be more than 500 basis points or more than 5% outperformance compared to that metric. Certainly past is not prologue, and we have other slides that talk about our performance as it compares to what Tim was talking about, diversification, inflation hedging characteristics. All of these, of course, are backward looking. And so what we want to talk about with the rest of the time that we have here is what are the processes, points of view that we have that we think have enabled that performance and that we think looking forward will give us the best chance of achieving and exceeding that performance as well. And one of the key things in that regard is that, and Steve touched upon it at the beginning, is that this is a cyclical industry in the sense that commodity prices can be quite volatile. So how can we achieve strong returns, you know, on a risk-adjusted basis, notwithstanding underlying commodities that are moving up and down? And so that's kind of our third topic that we wanted to address that Greg's going to hit on in the next couple of slides.
Sure, and we can move to slide 14 to cover that. What we're looking at here is pricing of oil. The bottom axis would be time, so over 20-year time period. On the left-hand axis is price. You can see oil prices have been volatile, but we could have used natural gas, corn, copper, gold as a surrogate here. They're all volatile. I think we would step back and say we're not commodity investors. We invest in growing private companies that operate in the commodity businesses. But volatility is just really the name of the game. It's just what we're used to. If we look on the right-hand side of this page, we'll see the latest cycle we're in right now, where prices on the right-hand side fell by 54% over the past year from roughly $100 a barrel to where we're trading right now, which is this morning opened up around $49 a barrel. You can see, though, other cycles that are as large, if not larger. If you go back a little bit to the left, you'll see that big spike. That's before and during the credit crisis when prices spiked well over $100 a barrel and then fell by 70%. You can see other cycles, if you go back in time. One I might highlight, between 95 and 2000, there's a very significant cycle, a 55% drop in oil prices over a very long time period. Oil prices fell below $9 a barrel. That was a really tough cycle. And the reason why I bring that up is we've invested through all these cycles. If you look at those green ovals on the right, on the top, you'll see we've raised and managed programs throughout these cycles. And we think we've had some quality performance. And the reason why we've been able to do that is we have what we call our three principles. Our investment principles are we want to work with high quality management teams. Typically teams that have been through cycles, have invested and operated through cycles, and can capitalize on cycles on the way out. We really try to focus on low finding and development costs. That's the name of the game. We want to be the low cost provider. And we'll talk more about that in the presentation. But with oil prices at 49, you have to be able to find a way of breaking even at well below 49. There's a big disparity between the high and the low of where finding development costs and break-even costs are here, at least in the U.S.
As you look in the rearview mirror of some of these events, and I frankly had forgotten, I just don't seem to have registered that 55% drop that you highlighted. To $9 a barrel for some reason. I'm not remembering that. But as you look back at those past events, how do the drivers for those compare to what you see now in terms of the current state of the natural resource market, particularly oil?
And we can go in drivers as far as the investment considerations or more of the supply and demand?
Well, I'm thinking if I'm assuming that there's an opportunity here that is cyclical,
yeah,
in nature, and that the opportunity arose in each of these prior cycles for some reason. In other words, the opportunity was created because there were drivers that caused the price of oil to go to,
yeah,
$9 a barrel, or just like there's drivers now that take it to 49. So my question is, how does the past experience of looking at what caused those troughs compare to what you see now?
There's a lot of similarities. The big difference of this cycle would be that one of the big drivers is that production worldwide, especially here in the U.S., because of that revolution that you heard about in oil and gas, really put a lot more crude on the market. And then the reaction from Saudi Arabia this time was to flood the market with oil to maintain their market share. They said, enough is enough. We're not going to be the swing producer. That was different than the prior cycles. This cycle here is much more also, though, technology-driven by the amazing technologies that have been spawned here in North America that have driven a lot of the increase in production here in the U.S. and Canada.
One of our key messages is that we know that there are cycles, but we're not investing based on cycles because of what Greg was talking about, looking for people that are producing, having low finding and development costs, so you can survive those downdrafts and then benefit, when there are upswings. So, the returns obviously are influenced by that, but it's the fact that you're not going out of business during the down cycle and playing for the long term that generate, we think, the long-term returns that we're targeting.
There was an article maybe a week ago in the Wall Street Journal that I found of great interest on exactly this topic, and I don't know if you looked at it, if you had any reaction, that the essence of which was that when you start dropping off producers because of the cost of the price of the oil not being sufficient to cause it to make sense, that has a compounding effect that comes into effect fairly quickly. And within a couple of years, the theme of the article, we get out of this supply being in excess of demand and get back to a world where demand, which continues to grow, that was also part of the theme, increases supply, and we go back to an increasing price. Do you build that into any of what you do, and did you happen to see the article and any reaction to it?
Yeah, we've been following that because a lot of our producers are exactly what the article is talking about. And so, for instance, a lot of the oil shale producers in our portfolio, their decline rates may be 80%. They drill a well, they produce 100 units on January 1, and by December 31, they're producing 20 units of oil. So the decline rates are very rapid. That's really what's feeding the premise of that article.
And if you're not drilling new ones, very quickly your overall production is going down.
However, I think what we really want to stay away from is predicating our performance on ever-rising pricing. You have to make money at $49 a barrel. That's really where we are in our portfolio. Because I think people get trapped into thinking, well, fundamentally, most economists right now probably think oil long term might be $60 to $90 a barrel. But we really need to be able to get comfortable that we can produce and economically at today's pricing. And that's really been the sort of the strategy that we've used throughout the 20 years of our programs. The other really principle is low leverage. I think a lot of this cycle has been spawned and the hardship by higher leverage ratios than what we would have had 10 and 20 years ago in some of these companies, especially the high yield market. And the debt to market, the debt to capitalization in our portfolio is quite low. It's about 20%. Many companies out there might have debt to capitalization ratios of say 40 or 50%. And so one of the principles that we've always utilized is low leverage. We don't want to generate performance necessarily by using high amounts of financial leverage. Not in this environment, that's all over the place. That we think could be a recipe for disaster. We need to stay alive when prices are low and then capitalize when prices move back up.
So is this a distressed asset kind of an investment?
I think partially. Yeah, we can talk about that if you like. If you move to the next slide, page 15, what we're showing here is our point of view. And we think that another important area is to have a distinct point of view, which changes over time. And if I just drop back, what page 15 is showing is that there's sort of six sub-industries in which one can invest in natural resources. We cover all of them. We have a large enough team to do that. We put, though, particular emphasis right now on the areas in the green boxes. We're not
the dark green
boxes. And that's because there's some level of inflections or stress or distress in those areas. The biggest area of distress right now is the mining space, where public mining stocks are down about 50% from where they were in 2011. So public stocks have really gotten hammered. The private companies really have virtually no access to debt and equity capital outside of just a few people in private equity that focus on that channel. And so the opportunity set there is, we think, greater. The valuations are much lower than they would have been several years ago. So we've gravitated our portfolio a bit more in that direction. I think, though, that you think of us, though, as generally not a distressed investor. It's really, though, pulling out assets from stressed or distressed companies. Mm-hmm. I can give you one example. In your portfolio, the commitment you made a couple years ago with us, I was just out in the field in northern Arizona at a company called Mineral Park. Mineral Park is a very large copper mine. They also mine silver and zinc. It started about 60 years ago. It was owned by a public company. That public company invested about $400 million into Mineral Park, especially over the last several years. The company had revenue of $200 million in 2013, went bankrupt in 2014 because of low commodity prices and high leverage, and was bought by Waterton, one of our distressed managers, for $10 million 3 months ago. It's just an amazing asset. There's a lot of optionality there, and Waterton has a whole host of technical and operating people that can go in and properly manage that asset. But most of our assets will be bought from companies that are either in some level of stress, distress, or just changing things. They're selling smaller properties, things they can't figure out, areas that are just really not large enough to move the needle. And that's really, you know, again, a lot of what we focus on, especially in the oil and gas business.
It sounds like those are all basis-driven investments, whether it be the misfortune of the company that, you know, BK'd, or, you know, you've got a distressed entity. It sounds like it's all driven by basis.
Right now, more of that. But, you know, over the cycle, a lot of it's driven just by new ideas, new technologies, new geological concepts, saying, well, gosh, I could actually start looking at oil shales and use, you know, horizontal drilling technologies to do that. 5 and 10 years ago, that really wasn't the thought process. And then actually taking all those, that thought, the U.S. ingenuity and technology, and moving it overseas. That, we think, is a track that we'll probably be following for the rest of our careers.
Sure. I've got a couple questions about this page. Technology has obviously been one of the big breakthroughs for oil. Am I to infer from the alternative energy thing that we're short of a technological breakthrough at this point? We've kind of hit a lull, and if there is something that comes along that's a big technological breakthrough in alternative energy, it might start going again, or is it just lack of drying up of government subsidies?
We think the alternative area is very interesting, and it's the highest growth area on this page. It's starting from a very low base, and a lot of the projects that are out there available to us are just really under the risk return of what we're looking for, that 10 to 15% return, that CPI plus 600 basis points. A lot of those projects pencil out to sort of 5, 6, 7% rates of return. A number of the solar and wind projects are more very low-risk infrastructure-style projects with a lot of competition for those projects. So that's really one of the big reasons why we don't play as much there. The other challenge in the marketplace is because, say, natural gas prices, which are so low right now, they can undercut a lot of those, you know, some of the interesting, say, solar projects available. But having said all that, the cost of solar, if you've watched it over the last 5 years, it's unbelievable how far down it's come. And in a number of parts of the U.S., especially south of here, you're at grid parity with solar power. So it's not that we don't think highly of the area. It's just that generally the rates of returns in those areas are not as attractive as some of the other areas that we like to focus on.
And overlaying all that, we got to find quality teams, because these are private investments that get, you know, invested in day one and managed over a five-year time period. And so you need to have certainty that the team you're backing as well is the one that you want to back over a long time period.
And one other question on this page, if I might. On mining, is there any, are you into rare earths at all?
Very, very small part. It's less than 1% of our portfolio.
But, and is that domestic, or is that? I'm getting the sense that China's kind of gotten their arms wrapped around rare earths.
China produces most of the rare earths in the U.S. There's actually a mine in California you've probably heard about in eastern California on the way to Vegas. It's the largest rare earth mine in the U.S. There's very few rare earth mines outside of China.
Which has now gone through bankruptcy again.
Molycorp. We actually had a position in that before it went public.
Yeah.
So we actually made a really nice return in Molycorp.
The interesting thing about that, I mean, if you look at the rare earth stuff, there's such a demand for that, and the Chinese apparently have been able to wrap that up, not only in their own area, but they've wrapped up some industry within the United States and have purchased that industry before anybody decided that it was really, people in the United States didn't have the foresight, apparently, that we might have. But also, I guess environmental impact on Molycorp has been, if you look at it that way, devastating, because there's virtually no concern about that in China.
Correct. A lot of the mines in China in rare earths are actually not federally regulated. They're illegal mines, and the Chinese government will likely start shutting a lot of those mines down. They already have. By the way, we put a lot of emphasis on ESG. We're a member of the Principles for Responsible Investing.
ESG, environmental, social governance.
And, you know, we factor that into our investment decision-making process. You know, we don't want to exclude investments like oil and gas or extractive businesses from our portfolio. We want to actually have a seat at the board, seat at the table, to drive change in those companies to be, you know, a best practice in that industry, because we think these are vital parts of our society.
So you said you had a position once before in Molycorp. Would there I'm probably digging down too deep into this, but and you couldn't say anything if you wanted to, but is that another opportunity at this point because they're another distressed asset to look at again?
Yes, it could be. Yeah, a lot of what we're looking at right now in the U.S. would be in the copper and gold areas. There's a lot of dislocation in that business right now, but that could be another target for private capital for sure. I've actually been out to the mine. It's a fascinating project.
Despite them running ads like crazy, gold, I noticed, is at a five-year low. So.
Yeah.
But you should still be buying that gold and silver as much as you possibly can.
Yeah. So a lot more on the point of use, but we are very focused on, again, all these areas, but really more on where we think value lies. The oil field services business is also quite interesting right now. It's going to go through another period of hardship over the next 6 months, we think. You can buy these companies generally for lower purchase prices. You can aggregate these companies together. They're very fragmented. And then the chance, I think, for us is to take these companies, build them into global franchises, and again, move that technology and management know-how around the world. That is an area where we've made a lot of money over the last 10 years.
We'd like to pick up with our fourth topic, which is really, you know, you've heard all about our investment process, and now it's, you know, what are we proposing building for Contra Costa? So we'll ask Greg to take us through that.
Yeah, and maybe just briefly on page 16, so what we propose is to construct a portfolio, what you can see on the left-hand side, left-hand pie, with various sub-industries and attractive companies. This is where we would begin, likely, because of what's happening in the markets right now. We would think that probably about half would be oil and gas, and the remaining portions would be probably more oriented towards mining, power, ag, and timber. On the right-hand side, that pie chart, you'll see we'll focus not only on primaries, but also on secondaries and co-investments, where we have also very high-quality track records. And just as an aside, the secondary and co-investment areas can really be some nice value-added components to this portfolio. Typically, in secondaries, you're paying a much lower fee because you're buying someone else out of their partnership. And you might be buying a five-year-old partnership where, therefore, you don't pay management fees. You also may pay a discount for that, which we typically do. On the co-investment side, we typically pay no fee or carry for those investments. So all in, we think there's a lot of value in focusing even more attention on those two areas. At the same time, we're targeting some really interesting primary opportunities, and that's an area where we've had, you know, a plethora of experience. Deal flow is a very important component on page 17 of our process. The last 12 months, we started with, we looked at 299 opportunities. We boiled that down to about half as many. You can see in the middle, put a lot of emphasis on those transactions, those doing that diligence. We invested in 8 of those opportunities. So in essence, we invested in less than 3% of what we analyzed. And the reason why we want to hire another person on our team is to really further bolster that deal flow. That's a low percentage. That's a good thing to be that sort of that picky in the marketplace.
At what point did the funnel reach the investment committee?
The funnel would reach the investment committee about midway through that second lens, the 160. We would start talking to the investment committee about projects every week that we're working on, and we would have put forth paper memos in front of the investment committee, probably more on about 25 of the opportunities. What we would have is a cursory game plan, just saying we would like to do more work on this opportunity. What do you think? And then that boils down to that 8 level. It's a little bit misleading because the work we do in secondaries, we're bidding on a lot of different things in secondaries, and so we're putting a lot more of those kind of packages in front of our investment committee because that's just the nature of that business.
That would seem more time sensitive.
Very time sensitive, very transactional. Whereas the other parts, co-investing, primaries, we can generally spend 3 or 4 months on average, and sometimes we'll spend years researching an individual company. For different reasons, it might take that long.
It's an integrated, you know, as we talked about the investment committee, these are all people that are active, you know, across all of our business, so it's not like some external group of people, and we go off-site twice a year and review our businesses, review what's going on, so while we wouldn't necessarily go through all 299. We'd probably see a good cross-section of that through various things that, you know, Greg and Ethan and the team would lead on, hey, here's what's happening in natural resources. We'll take a deep dive in this space. We're looking at these managers. And so we all have a pretty good view of what's happening in the space. And it's because we do run as an integrated team, and we work together for a long time, and we go off-site, and we spend a lot of time together understanding the nuances and facets of all our businesses that we're active in.
We also bring our team out to the field to make sure they understand what mines look like, oil and gas. We've been offshore, onshore, above ground, below ground. You know, it's a really pretty interesting part of the job.
And one part of the funnel being broad at the top is there's a lot of people that will come to us because, you know, we've been in business for a long time, we've had a consistent team, we've got experience, and the hard part is a general partner for many firms or people showing us co-investments is you can go a lot of places to find money, but you have a lot fewer places to go to find people that will give you feedback, you know, the benefit of their experience, things that they've seen over time. So that really helps us widen that funnel at the top. And then, of course, you know, we talked about how we narrow that down into things that we think are really interesting.
Page 19 just outlines our investment process. Again, we think it's very thorough. It starts with rigorous research on the left, moves through due diligence, active portfolio construction, our investment committee process, and then investment management oversight. That can go on for, you know, for years and years. These are long-term investments. It's a process we've used for 20 years. We've honed it along the way. We go offsite every 6 months, like Ken says. We pull apart our process, figure out what's working, what's not working, change it. But by and large, it's a very similar process to what we've used for decades. A lot of pattern recognition.
So if you have an epiphany one morning or you get a phone call, can you bypass the first five or six boxes and get down closer to the end? In other words, can you jump all that?
We can if we know that industry, that management team. We've worked with that management team before, known them, know exactly what they're doing. Maybe the field or the mining commodity they're looking at, or maybe an ag commodity, we can go pretty quickly through that process. But typically, it takes us if you put secondaries aside, typically it still takes us at least a month or two to go through the soup to nuts process. And you know, we'll miss transactions, but really we want to mitigate our, you know, the risk profile of what we do, and part of that is just making sure we do our thorough work.
And the middle part of this graph is probably less linear in reality, but you know, a number of these things are going on at the same time: reference checking, quantitative analysis, and you know, so it's not probably depicted exactly how it works in process for those early parts of the stages.
So, for instance, we're bidding on a timber secondary right now. We know those assets. We're already in the assets. We'll bid on that asset at different times over the next 2 years, probably 3, 4, or 5 times. So we literally just have it on the shelf, and we're just pulling the work off the shelf, refreshing it. We can go through that pretty quickly.
And that referencing is key. I mean, we're in a business where reputation matters, and because, you know, you sign agreements that go out for 10 years and you're obligating yourself to give people money when they ask for it, you have to be very confident that they're going to do the right thing in a number of scenarios that you can think of and maybe not think of. And so the network that we draw on to ask about the people that we want to sign up with for long term is very important. And you know, you just say no if it doesn't check out. And the speed is one of the factors. We have a big team, and so we can move very fast, but these are long term investments. And so, you know, you have to be very sure when you make those commitments that that's what you want to do.
Any other questions on the process? So the fifth and final topic we wanted to just cover quickly is how we're going to partner with you, how that partnership is going to evolve over time. I'm going to talk from page 21, a simplistic chart, but you know, we've enjoyed a terrific relationship with you and the team over the last couple of years. We're looking forward to the opportunity expanding that relationship in this custom solution. We are selective in who we bring in as partners. So today we work with 4 other separate accounts. And that's important to us because we want to have a very open communication flow, information sharing that helps us do our job better. We want to serve as an extension of your investment resources, so bringing ideas to you, you bringing ideas to us, but also an extension of the operational back office functions. So Greg mentioned a 50-person team, 25 people focused on investments. That'll be your natural resources team looking for investments all over the world, diligencing those investments, and ultimately making those investments. We also have another 25 people who are focused on operations and back office stuff that will be at your disposal as well. And then lastly, we've worked very closely with your team over the last several months crafting a structure that we think creates high alignment between us. And so we're looking forward to those economic and partnership benefits as we continue the relationship. Very specific questions on any of the terms or economics of the proposal that we've put forth?
Can you describe your favorite of the eight finalists, the eight that were selected? Just to give us a flavor for what one of these
would
look like.
Well, they're
the favorite of the eight. We love all our
children. Because you're an investor in our standard program, they're actually all in your program. I would probably highlight, I'm not sure I have my favorite, but I would highlight one that was really a interesting project. It was a mining manager where we bought a secondary in their fund one and two at a 25% discount. Just about a month ago, and it took us 5 months to diligence that. The manager is based in Australia. I had just been over with two of my colleagues doing some work on managers. This came up when I came back. We had five people working on it pretty much full time for that 5 month time period. Very complicated, technical. Some of the assets are all over the world, a lot of tax considerations, and we're really excited about that secondary. It's a very value buy in some attractive mining assets around the world with a quality organization. We though have worked in oil and gas on your behalf. We have a couple of timber secondaries again that we're working on right now. Those are very interesting. We've worked on a couple of other secondaries, and we purchased a secondary 3 months ago in a firm called Metalmark. It's a New York-based firm. They do a lot of work in the energy space and chemicals as well. That also has its own twist to it. It was an interesting project. We actually already own two of the companies in your portfolio. We were co-investors with them, and one in particular, so we knew that portfolio quite well. Another project is over in the UK North Sea. It's an oil and gas project. We're looking at a couple of things in the clean energy space right now that we think are actually very attractive as well. I'm not sure I answered your question.
No, that's fine. I was looking for a more ground level description, and you did that just fine. That's what I was looking for.
Speaking of due diligence, you make a reference in there to not being able to do third party background checks in some situations. Does that suggest that you, in some cases, might proceed without it, or is that a deal killer?
It's difficult to do in certain international jurisdictions, as an example.
I'll bet.
And so we will mitigate the risk of that by the exposure or the size of the investment. And so it's not a deal killer, but it's one of the factors that we would assess when making an investment. And much easier to do that in the developed world, as an example, especially here in North America.
They become increasingly less valuable as you move away from the U.S. We were working with a manager in Latin America on the private equity side, not natural resources, had the third-party checks. They came back perfectly clean, but through our contacts, we knew one of the GPs was involved in a political situation, having made contributions, and we found the article. We had Spanish speakers on the team, and were able to do that the third party had never picked up. So they're increasingly less valuable as you get further away from the U.S.
I'll show my ignorance. What kind of resources are we looking at in Greenland, or are you looking at?
There's only one. There's an iron ore mine there called Baffin, and it's probably one of the highest concentrations of iron ore on Earth. It's literally, we literally be like walking on metal. It's on the surface, and it's an extraordinary asset. It's just happens to be in Greenland, yeah. And you have to build a large train line to actually mine that asset. So it's otherwise we have no other exposure there.
I just didn't know what else was up there.
Yeah.
Soon to be a lot more water.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, they call it Greenland for one reason, because it used to be green. Damn global warming.
Any further questions? Yes?
Just one question. Today we're discussing about $100 million commitment and with a new separate account structure. So with this coming in, do we have a higher priority over other LPs when it comes to investment opportunities?
Yeah, so we have, when we think about the capital we raise, we limit either the funds or the separate accounts based on the opportunities that we see. So in the case of natural resources, we think in a given cycle, call it 2 to 3 years, we can deploy about $1 billion in very high quality opportunities across natural resources. So we have a $500 million fund, which is capped at $500 million to make room for any separate account or custom accounts that we have. And this would be the only dedicated natural resources separate account that we have. So we think there's plenty of capacity. We have an allocation policy. It's been in place for a couple of years. The investment committee governs that that process. And we think that the fair and equitable treatment of all of our clients is important. We're aligned with you financially in this account as well as the fund. So we have every incentive to make sure, that good stuff gets into everything.
Thank you.
Thank you.
No further questions? I think, thank you very much for the presentation.
Thank you all.
I think probably it's a good time to take 5 minutes and then some of you come back up.
Okay. We appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Would you like to have me see them out, John?
Why don't you please share it?